All right. First, we're going to hear from Dr. Carrie Hornbuckle. Dr. Hornbuckle is the Donald E. Bentley Professor of Engineering and Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. She also serves on the faculty of the Interdisciplinary Graduate Program in Human Toxicology. Her research examines how polychlorinated biphenols, or PCBs, and other toxic semi-volatile organic pollutants are released and transported through the environment. She and her team operate large-scale air sampling networks in Chicago, Northwest Indiana, and rural Iowa. They conduct field and laboratory measurements of PCBs and related compounds in indoor and outdoor air, water, sediment, soils, human serum, and tissues from laboratory animals. Her research is supported by the Iowa Superfund Research Program as well as the Great Lakes National Program Office of the U.S. EPA and the National Science Foundation. Dr. Hornbuckle is a past president of the International Association for the Great Lakes Research and is associate editor of the American Chemical Society Journal Environmental Science and Technology. She was awarded an Early Career Development Award from NSF, the University of Iowa Distinguished Achievement Award for the Women Faculty, and the College of Engineering Distinguished Research Award. Carrie, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Felicia, and thank you all for joining us today. Please excuse my scratchy voice. I have a little bit of a cold, but I'm hoping that you can all hear me all right. And I want to thank the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences for sponsoring this webinar and also for funding to support the Iowa Superfund Research Program, which funds the work that I'm going to talk about today. Let's see if I can make this work. There we go. So I'm going to talk about PCBs and particularly analysis that drives discovery and determination of fate and transport of PCBs in environmental systems as well as in humans. PCBs are both legacy and current contaminants with current sources that come from inadvertent production, including that of pigments that are used in household paints and many consumer products. Current sources of PCBs from inadvertent manufacturing is not managed under the same ban that prohibited the production and sales of aerochlors that discontinued in 1977. I'm also going to talk a bit about hydroxylated PCBs. They're both metabolites and also found in the environment, and they have toxic properties that are similar, and in some case, more aggravated than PCBs. We are exposed to PCBs through diet, through dermal exposure and inhalation. PCBs have a variety of toxicological effects and are classified as group 1 human carcinogens. There's still a lot of concerns about PCBs, especially the legacy ones, because legacy aerochlors remain in use. They're used in light ballast capacitors, they're used in transformers, they're still present in caulking in many buildings, adhesives, many other uses. They are still actively present. And as a result, humans are still exposed and people are continue to be concerned about that. This is just a variety of headlines in the last year or two addressing concerns about PCBs and our environment. So today what I want to talk about is methods that we use at the research scale to examine fate and transport and human exposure of PCBs. And I'm going to talk about methods that we use in the laboratory that provide us the detailed and high-quality information necessary to capture subtle changes and to compare across many different samples and matrices. So first I'm going to talk about extraction and cleanup of the environmental samples and how we handle that in order to protect the samples and have the lowest possible detection limits, the cleanest blanks, and the highest reproducibility and accuracy. And how we analyze it, we use the triple quadrupole, GC-MS-MS, for this. And I'm going to talk a little bit, quite a bit about this. There is not yet an official EPA method that uses this instrument, but I think there could be, and perhaps some of you might be interested in the comparison between our findings with this instrument and the approved EPA methods. I'm going to conclude with briefly discussing major findings that we have been able to produce as a result of using these methods, and then I'll open it up for questions and discussion. So the extraction and cleanup of samples, we are handling a variety of environmental samples in our laboratory. We handle hundreds, maybe thousands of air samples because we're operating networks for air samplings in indoor and outdoor air across the city of Chicago and East Chicago in northwest Indiana and in rural Iowa. We also analyze for human blood serum collected from our cohort studies in northwest Indiana and rural Iowa. We analyze for sediments we collect in the Great Lakes region and elsewhere, water samples, and try to use a similar method across all matrices in order to allow them to be compared. We use accelerated solvent extraction or pressurized solvent extraction for most of our work because of its speed and reliability. We use the Dynex ACE, I said ACE 300, but actually now we're using the ACE 350, which works pretty nicely and actually behaves quite well. We concentrate the samples using TurboVap, and then we run it through a silica gel that's acidified and eluted with hexane. We typically use manual columns for this work because we can control and view the process clearly. However, we also have a method for a fluid management system for automated cleanup, and I provide some information on the supporting information on our website about that work. Then we use two kinds of standards for evaluating the efficiency of our extraction and handling of the sample throughout the extraction cleanup. We use these three PCBs as surrogate standards added at the beginning of the extraction process, and we use these PCBs, deuterated PCB 30 and PCB 204, as internal standards in, for this method. We've been including OHPCBs for the last few years. We started this work when we were evaluating OHPCBs in human blood serum because hydroxylated PCBs are major metabolites of PCBs processed by mammals and also by plants and other organisms. In order to do that, we have to acidify the sample in order to get the hydroxylated PCBs in the neutral form, and then we can extract it just like PCBs using hexane and acetone. We then separate the OHPCBs by, again, adjusting the pH of the solution, and then we derivatize them using diazomethane and to methoxylated PCBs. Methoxylated PCBs are sufficiently volatile, and so we can analyze them by GC-MS-MS. We use similar methods to clean and extract these as well. For the hydroxylated PCBs, they have their own surrogate standards and their own internal standards in order to evaluate efficiency of recovery. So the methods that we use can be compared to EPA methods for extraction and cleanup. And our method for pressurized solvent extraction is quite similar to EPA 3545A. Our cleanup method is similar to 3665A. However, we are running it with through sulfuric acidified silica rather than using a liquid-liquid sulfuric acid separation. So we found that there's significant time and cost savings of cleaning our sample, extracting and cleaning our samples using accelerated solvent extraction, and this figure just illustrates it for air samples. Since January, for example, we've cleaned 400 air sampling media that's then sent to our our staff in the field for deployment in our network sites. And we clean these samples using the accelerated solvent extraction system instead of using SOXLets, which we used to do 5 years ago. So now, comparing this preparation of the air sampling media between SOXLets and accelerated solvent extraction, you can see the time is much reduced. The amount of polyurethane foam air samples that is cleaned in one batch, the time necessary to clean all 400, 64 days when we were doing it by SOXLets, now down to 8 days for that magnitude. The solvent savings is significant. So estimating that our solvent's about $25 per 4 mils, we calculate that the difference is between $1,000 using SOXLets for those 400 air sampling and 200 now. So we are really getting much more consistent cleaning. We're getting just as good, if not better, contaminant removal and cost savings as well as time savings using this method. Actually, I think, for in addition to the time and the cost, the consistency of the quality of the cleanup is really important to us because all of our work depends on very clean blanks in order to get low detection limits. And using the accelerated solvent extraction system, we really can get rapid and consistently low blanks. Also, it's much more simple or straightforward to test how the quality of our blanks in each batch. So we run them the clean samples prior to releasing them to field. So the triple quadrupole tandem mass spectrometry provides us really good separation. It provides good selectivity and very low detection limits. Certainly comparable to what we were used to seeing on the ECD detector, but with much fewer false positives from other compounds. We can isolate it and detect pretty much just PCBs. So we analyzed for all 209 PCBs and 72 hydroxylated PCBs. We are unable to separate every single one, although we do use a column that separates the dioxin-like congeners. We end up with about 176 chromatographic peaks to detect all 209 congeners. And this figure illustrates the separation by transition. So the ions transitions for GCMS allow us to separate by homologue group. So at the top, this is the monohydroxylated, dihydroxylated, trihydroxylated, and to the bottom, the PCBs that are fully chlorinated. We have two of these instruments, and typically we use one of them with different columns and one of them for hydroxylated PCBs and other compounds, and one of them dedicated completely to OHPCB analysis. And this is just another view also of the separation by homologue group so that we are able to look for a distinct peak. So even if they elute at the same time, if they're different homologues, that is, they have a different number of chlorines, then we can separate the compounds. So I want to compare our method that we're using to the two other EPA methods that we have previously used or attempted to use. For many years, we used a version or modified version of EPA method 8082A. 8082A allows for electron capture detection, and it's primarily designed to identify PCBs as aerochlores. In the past, we indeed used as our calibration aerochlore mixtures. But we also were able to separate and identify the PCBs by congeners, although we had many co-eluting peaks and more uncertainties than we now have. EPA 1668A was published about 10, 12 years ago. And when it was first published, we tried it immediately, both with high-res, an instrument that we don't have in the lab but we're able to use elsewhere, and then we decided to develop it for the triple quad mass spec. So the method that we use is an adaptation of 1668C for the GC-MS-MS instead of a high-res instrument. Otherwise, it's a very similar approach. We use similar quality control measurements, including standard reference material, which is a very important part of our accuracy evaluation. We use the SP octal column as recommended by 1668A because that separates the dioxin-like compounds. And we use a DB1701 and a DB5 for confirmation. The 1668A uses many PCBs, surrogate standards for each homolog group, and we use fewer. It also uses many labeled PCBs for the isotope dilution method. And we do not have a labeled standard for every single PCB congener. Instead, we use two internal standards to calculate, and we found that this is sufficiently accurate and much less expensive than the 1668A method. So confirmation columns are not typically necessary for PCBs, but are frequently necessary for the hydroxylated PCBs. And we use the DB1701 as our confirmation column, and I'm just illustrating here the hydroxylated PCBs that have 1, 2, and 3 chlorines, so that you can see the sort of shift necessary or moving so that we can identify the OH PCBs. And this is in part necessary because there's so many hydroxylated PCBs. There's hundreds of hydroxylated PCBs, and we only analyze for 72 of those. However, the unlike PCBs, the transitions are not unique for each homolog group. And so illustrated here for the monochlorinated hydroxylated PCBs are three peaks for which we have the calibration standards. Same with the di and the tri. So there may be more hydroxylated PCBs than we are able to analyze, and they unfortunately do not all have the same transition. So we are currently blind to all the other hydroxylated PCBs. So we use a rigorous quality control to evaluate and assess the accuracy, the representativeness, the precision of the samples. We use field blanks, laboratory method blanks, and instrument blanks. The field blanks are used in order to calculate our limit of quantification. And we typically do not report detections lower than our LOQ, although in some cases we report detect, non-detect. I'll talk about that a little bit later. We use surrogate standard recoveries to evaluate precision, and we use the SRM for accuracy, to evaluate the accuracy. We use the SRM appropriate for each media, and in the papers I'll talk about later, and you can find for yourself on the web, in the supporting information we frequently include our findings for the SRM appropriate for that media. So I won't go into this detail of this slide, but I want to make the point that using this approach, we are able to provide a consistent evaluation of the PCBs in different matrices because we attempt to make the entire method from extraction to analysis comparable. And this has provided us a lot of power in interpreting the fate and transport of these chemicals in environmental systems. So now I want to talk about some of the applications that we've used this method. And first of all, we used the 1668A modification, and we discovered PCB11 in Chicago air. This is a non-air chlorine. This is first that it had been reported in the air. First we had seen it, and without the method I just described, we would not have observed it. Since then, there's been quite a bit of work on these chemicals, and we and others have shown that pigment manufacturing is the important source. PCBs vary in, according to the exact pigment because of the manufacturing process. So most of the pigments have these low molecular weight ones, but green paint, for example, has a very highly chlorinated PCB, and red paint has PCB52, which is also an aerochlor, very commonly found in the environment. We were able to show that Indiana harbors a source of PCBs to the surrounding community by directly comparing the concentrations of congeners in the air and water at the sediment collected simultaneously in this harbor. We are able to show how passive samplers are effective in capturing PCB congeners. And by the way, I didn't have time to talk about it, but an important method that we've developed recently is using passive samplers without depuration compounds to determine the flow rate using local meteorological data. Hydroxylated PCBs, we discovered them in aerochlor mixtures and also in sediment, and shown that their presence in air in Chicago is due to volatilization rather than chemical reaction in the atmosphere. The very low detection limits that we get with our method are critical in order for us to measure and report PCBs and hydroxylated PCBs in serum. Concentrations of PCBs in children's serum is especially low, but we have been able to report it and give us additional insight into the exposure that children have to these toxic chemicals. We are able to show that non-aerochlors that probably come from pigment manufacturing are also present in the blood of mothers and children, as well as hydroxylated PCBs, primarily from metabolism. Lastly, I want to mention that we've been able to show that a major source of exposure to children is from school air, and that's largely from contamination of aerochlors used in the building materials, but at least partially, there's evidence from modern sources of PCBs derived from paint pigment manufacturing. So I've taken a little bit longer than I should, but I want to just mention that you can find additional information on my website, including a link to our papers. And I've also provided standard operating procedures that we're using in our laboratory that you're free to use. I just ask that you cite our work if you use them. If you have any questions, you're welcome to contact me. Now, this is a picture of our team, and I want to note the three folks in the front, Andres Martinez, Andy Awad, and Rachel Marek are the first authors of several of the work I showed, as well as Nick Herkert. And this work, indeed, is funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Hornbuckle. We have a few questions on the line specifically about the pigments. Ellen Hughes asked what kind of pigments contain invert PCBs. Are there litholinks, fabric dyes, paints, or all of them?
Well, it's the paints that are produced by manufacturing of using organic processes. So paints that are made from minerals, and which includes most brown paints, black paints, brown, black, white, gray paints are from minerals and do not have an organic chemical manufacturing process, but brilliant colors do. And we have please look at our papers to describe our hypothesis about how that was exactly produced. Let's see, in this paper right here, you can see more information about our hypothesized mechanism that occurred. But now we're measuring these chemicals that specifically come from pigments in virtually every environmental sample that we analyze. PCB11 is the typically the largest. It's 3-3 prime dichlorobiphenyl, but there's several others.
All right. So assuming a person uses the high color pigments, that means they're exposed to PCBs. Is there any way they can reduce their exposure?
Well, we're not sure exactly how to answer that because we have yet to understand what exactly controls that exposure and what are all the sources. Sometimes new parents ask me this question, and I think it's, you know, relevant because we don't want babies exposed to PCBs unnecessarily. And to them, I say, well, maybe you should paint your baby's room in colors that use mineral pigments, like white and gray and black and brown. You know, painting your wall brilliant yellow is likely to, results in a release of these congeners. Yellow has a pretty strong signal from PCB11. I want to note these are very volatile, these PCBs that are light from these colors. And they're over here on the left-hand side of these plots because they have only one or two chlorines. Green paint, however, has these highly chlorinated ones that are much more bioaccumulative, and they will not volatilize, so they'll be there as long as your paint is.
You mentioned that the OH PCBs are major metabolites of PCBs in humans, animals, and plants. Can you comment about whether these are metabolized by the microbiome or by the cells or the organs of the macroorganism?
I'm not a good person to ask that question. I'm an engineer and a chemist. However, I do work with a lot of toxicologists that have published quite a bit about the mechanism for metabolism that produces hydroxylated PCBs. I'm a co-author on some of those, so you would find them on our reference list online. And you can follow up, and I can direct you to someone who can answer that question more specifically if you'd like.
Can you comment on the potential for using thermal desorption rather than solvent extraction methods to reduce lab worker exposure to emissions to the solvents? Specifically for PCBs, can the peaks be identified and the same analytical detection levels be reached with thermal desorption?
Well, we haven't used thermal desorption in part because we're working with samples that are really low and we have to concentrate a large volume. Like from air, we are typically managing hundreds of cubic meters of air collected on a foam disc. But if for higher concentrations or for passive sampling using of like sediment, higher concentrations, I have seen thermal desorption be useful. But we don't use it, so I shouldn't really comment on it. It isn't very helpful for the work that we're doing right now. Maybe in the future.
And I hope I'm pronouncing this. Soxhlet is specifically required under TSCA for PCB remediation projects. Do you know if EPA has approved the ASE-30 extraction method for PCB remediation projects?
No, I don't. I don't want to speak for EPA, although one of the reasons I'm doing this webinar is I think these methods are effective and should be considered for official methods, and I'd be happy to work with EPA should they decide to develop it as an official method. Thanks for asking.
In developing countries like India, we see informal e-waste recycling as a major source for PCBs. Can you suggest that this could be also considered as a newer source from in the developing world?
That's a good point. Yeah, releases of PCBs from e-waste is there's large fluxes from those sources, and I'm quite sure that near those sources in those countries, people are being exposed to airborne PCBs. Probably most of the PCBs that go into such sites are aerochlores, and therefore, the exposure be reflective of aerochlor exposure rather than individual PCBs, although I could be wrong. I think that there's a lot we do not yet know about manufacturing processes that inadvertently produce individual PCB congeners. And it's notable that this kind of production is not specifically banned. And if the release is to a open environment, like to air, then management of or control of the release is quite difficult and hard to pin down. I think there should be a lot more work to identify alternative manufacturing processes that don't produce PCBs as byproducts.
Is the CEM Mars extractor a good extracting process for PCBs?
I'm sorry, I don't know about that that method. But you can follow up and ask me by email if there's if you want to point me in the right direction. I'd be happy to take a look.
All right. Any issues on sediment prep process for sediments and transformer oils that for the analysis that you know of?
So we have analyzed transformer oils in our laboratory, and they're typically Aerochlor 1016. However, the concentrations are so high and they're so pure that actually you don't really need the all the cleanup procedures that I described here. We are able to just dilute those quite a lot and analyze them using the triple quad, the GC-MS-MS system that I described here.
And what about the prep process for sediments?
The prep process for sediments, we've used the pressurized solvent extraction method. It works really good with sediments. We mix it with diatomaceous earth in order to, so that we analyze only a small amount of sediment. But yeah, it works very well. We think the efficiency of extraction is thorough. It's a clean and reproducible method, and I recommend it. We've analyzed a lot of sediments using that method.
Before today's seminar, he had thought that all PCBs were Alicors. Is it generally known that there are other types of PCBs?
No, I think that it's the research community, those who study PCBs are well aware of this other source of PCBs, but it's pretty new, right? Our report of our finding of PCB-11 in Chicago Air, we published that in 2008. Prior to that, it hadn't been recognized that this was a widespread pollutant. It had been previously reported in the discharge from paint manufacturing in water. But since then, many researchers around the world have looked again at their samples, and I had phone calls from people who pulled up archived extracts and reanalyzed them to find these compounds that came from pigment manufacturing in their old samples. In fact, we analyzed sediment cores and were able to show that this has been a source of PCBs for a long time, probably since the 20s or 30s. It has a different historical profile than Aerochlor PCBs and more closely reflects the sales and production history of paint than the sales and production of Aerochlor. So, yeah, it's news that I think folks who are in the field and doing remediation of PCBs probably are not aware of. Certainly, Aerochlor contamination from waste, industry waste, is still the most important problem. And I mentioned exposure of children in schools and homes. We're finding mostly that's from Aerochlors. But yet, it's difficult to separate the PCBs that are produced by manufacturing from Aerochlors because some of them are the same congener. So PCB-11 we were able to catch because it's not an Aerochlor, but there's many PCBs that we find in pigment that are also in Aerochlors. So it's quite difficult to tease out what might be the major contribution unless you see PCB-11 is present. It's an interesting problem that our laboratory is working on quite a bit.
Do you have any suggestion for extracting blood samples for PCB using SPE?
That method works, although we're not able to get as clean a blank as we needed. We're analyzing very small volumes, like 4 milliliters of blood serum from children. And in order to capture the small amount of PCBs in that small volume, we didn't find the SPE method met our needs. With larger volumes, I think it would probably be fine. But again, the LOQ, the limit of quantification, is controlled entirely by the blank levels. And the blank levels for the entire method from collection to analysis, and it's very difficult to get really clean blanks. And so we've spent many years developing the blood method in order to be able to see it in those levels.
Okay. Now, last question, any comparison on the PCB and OHPAH detection limits using the GCHRMS versus the GCMSMS?
Well, yes, the detection limits are lower using high-res mass spec than they are for the triple quad method that we're using on the instrument detection limit. But we are finding that our limit of quantification is really controlled by the management of the entire collection, extraction, cleanup, and analysis process, it's not limited by the instrument detection limit. So we believe that the triple quad method is sufficiently sensitive and selective compared to the high res as long as you control the blanks through the whole process. In fact, because that's the major problem, the high res is going to have the same limit of quantification because it's driven by the blank levels. I hope I'm being clear about that. It's not the instrument detection limit that drives so much of this work as the method detection limits.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hornbuckle. It is now time to move on to the next presentation. If you submitted a question or submit one later that we didn't get to, we may have time to answer it later in the webinar. If not, we'll pass on any open questions along to the presenter. Next, we will hear from Dr. Jennifer Guilfo. Dr. Guilfo is a postdoctoral researcher and state agency's liaison in the Brownfields Research Program. She is active in both research and research translation related to analysis, fate transport, and remediation of contaminants in groundwater. Her current research focuses on understanding key physiochemical variables governing fate, transport, and remediation of poly and pyrophilo-alkali substances and the development of user-friendly tools for spatial identification of potential PFAS source zones. Dr. Guilfo completed her PhD at the Colorado School of Mines studying PFAS, fate, and transport, and she also has a combination of academic consulting and industry experience providing her with diverse perspectives on environmental management. Jennifer, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I'd like to thank NIEHS for the invitation to join the webinar day today and speak to you about some work that we have been doing at Brown University, trying to develop a user-friendly framework that can be applied towards identification of potential source zones of groundwater contamination due to per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, compounds. As the title slide implies, oftentimes when we approach a groundwater-impacted site, we prioritize the risk associated with that site by looking at not only the source of the groundwater contaminants, but understanding that there is a fate and transport pathway, as well as a potential receptor for those contaminants. And what I'm going to focus on today really looks at efficient techniques where you could potentially identify source zones on a regional basis. So, okay, here we go. This is an overview of my talk today. I'm going to start by giving an overview of these compounds, as well as look at the occurrence of these compounds in U.S. drinking water, specifically through the eyes of data that has been collected by the EPA as part of their UCMR effort. And then I will present our work to date, creating a geospatial framework for evaluation of PFAS source zones. So starting first with what PFAS compounds are, again, that stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, and so there's really two primary groups of compounds in that term, and the first are the perfluoroalkyl substances, and that some examples of perfluoroalkyl substances are what are currently shown at the top of the slide. These are two different groups of perfluoroalkyl substances, specifically the carboxylates and the sulfonates. They differ from each other primarily by that functional group that's on the end of the molecule. The thing that makes them perfluoroalkyl substances is really that fluoroalkyl tail. So if you look at that alkyl tail that's joined to the functional group on those molecules, you'll see that all of the carbons are bonded to fluorine, and that's why we call them perfluoroalkyl substances. So it's really just a terminology question. Now, these compounds do come in varying chain lengths. Some examples of those are shown here, but that is by no means a comprehensive list of the chain lengths that these can be found in. But these two groups, the carboxylates and the sulfonates, encompass the two PFAS compounds that are probably the most well-studied and the most heard about, and that is perfluorooctanoate and perfluorooctane sulfonate, or PFOA and PFOS. But the other portion of the term, the polyfluoroalkyl substances, is a little bit different. So we have an example now at the bottom of the screen in green of a polyfluoroalkyl substance. It still has that fluoroalkyl tail, but now you'll see that there are also carbons bonded to hydrogen elsewhere in its structure. That's why we don't call it a perfluoroalkyl substance and instead call it a polyfluoroalkyl substance. The polyfluoroalkyl substances do also occur in varying chain lengths, and I should point out that this is just one example of a polyfluoroalkyl substance. There are many, many different types of polyfluoroalkyl substances, and this is just one example. So how big is this compound class as a whole? That's really what this slide is meant to get at. This is a figure from a paper by Robert Buck. It's an open source paper. The citation's down there at the bottom. Anyone can go online and download it. That kind of talks about everything that fits into the world of PFAS, so you can see that there are quite a few things that can be considered PFAS compounds. So how many compounds, individual compounds, is that? Well, this is a paper that recently came out in Environmental Science and Technology, where the authors point out that there are more than 3,000 PFAS compounds that either are or have been on the market. So those 3,000 are potentially environmentally relevant. Plus, we have to consider the fact that users and producers of these compounds can come up with new PFAS compounds that we may not be aware of because that information is often proprietary. And then you may have heard a lot about the recalcitrance of some members of this class of compounds, and that is certainly true. We'll talk a little bit more about it later in the talk, but suffice it to say that some of the polyfluoroalkyl compounds can transform, and so their transformation products are also potentially relevant PFAS compounds. And so the world of potentially environmentally relevant PFAS compounds is quite large. So why are these compounds used in such a diversity of products and applications? Why are they so useful, and why are there so many of them? It's because they have some really unique and useful chemistry. And much of that really gets back to the certain properties of fluorine that lend these compounds their unique characteristics. And those properties are shown across the top of the slide. The first is the high electronegativity of fluorine. So when it's engaged in a covalent bond with carbon, it wants to hold the electrons very tightly to itself. And as a result of that, that carbon-fluorine covalent bond is the strongest known covalent bond in organic chemistry. And then in the middle of the top of the slide, you'll see this idea of polarizability. So the two molecules that are shown there have some overlap in their partial negative and partial positive charges. That's because those are polarizable molecules and they have engaged in that weak intermolecular interaction. However, fluorine will not do that. It does not engage in these types of intermolecular interactions. And then lastly, or I should say it has only weak intermolecular interactions. And then lastly, we have the small size of fluorine, which allows it to very effectively shield carbon from the kinds of attack that might help to, for example, promote degradation. So if you put all this together, you get some really unique properties of these compounds. For the compounds where the fluoroalkyl tail has an acidic functional group, the acidity of those compounds is very strong acidity, so they deprotonate at a very low pH. That includes the carboxylic acids and sulfonates like PFOA and PFOS. They also have a very high thermal and chemical stability. And then that fluoroalkyl tail is both hydrophobic and lipophobic, meaning that it's not like to be in either the aqueous or, for example, grease phases. It would actually prefer to be in the air. And when you couple that that tendency to want to be in the air with something like a hydrophilic head group, something like a deprotonated carboxylic acid, then that hydrophilic functional group actually tethers that molecule in aqueous phase at the air-water interface. So they have, some of them have some unique surfactant properties at that air-water interface. And so because of that, they've been used in a lot of products and applications, some of which are shown here. So they've been used, for example, in food paper packaging products for their grease repellent properties. They've been used in nonstick fabric treatments for their stain repellent properties. They've been used in certain kinds of firefighting foams, known as aqueous film-forming foams, due to their thermal stability and surfactant properties. And they've also been used in things like fluoropolymer manufacturing for the manufacturing of certain types of fluoropolymers, such as Teflon, that may be applied as coatings on metals or plastics. So these, this is why they are so useful, but it is also why they are so recalcitrant. So the stability means that these compounds, once released, are extremely difficult to degrade. The perfluoroalkyl acids like PFOA and PFOS have no known degradation pathways once they are released into the environment, so there is a lot of concern about their recalcitrance. And then the polyfluoroalkyl compounds, as I alluded to earlier, those can transform, but their terminal endpoints do include perfluoroalkyl acids, so they still represent concern when it comes to recalcitrance in the environment. And it's because of this, as well as concerns with their toxicity, that some of these compounds are being targeted for extremely low standards or health advisories regarding their levels in drinking water. So last year we saw that the EPA issued some drinking water health advisories for two members of the PFAS family, specifically PFOA and PFOS. That advisory is 70 nanograms per liter for those compounds present either individually or in combination in drinking water. But this is just a non-enforceable recommendation for maximum levels of these compounds in drinking water at this point, and it is up to the states, individual states, to decide whether they want to officially regulate these compounds in drinking water, and some are definitely opting to do that. Some are using this 70 nanogram per liter health advisory that has been set out by the EPA, but others are doing it differently. So, for example, in Vermont, they have a 20 nanogram per liter standard for PFOA and PFOS in combination. And then in New Jersey, for example, they have two individual standards, 14 nanograms per liter for PFOA and 10 nanograms per liter for perfluoronanoate, which is just one CF2 group bigger than PFOA. But no matter which way you look at it, or these standards are targeting the low parts per trillion level, which raises the question of how much do they occur in U.S. drinking water, and are they at levels that are of concern? And one way that we can look at that is through data that has been collected by the EPA as part of their UCMR data collection effort. UCMR stands for Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, and this was or is an effort by the EPA to sample public drinking water systems for a suite of contaminants that are currently unregulated. This includes a lot of different things. It's not just PFAS compounds, but it does include six perfluoroalkyl acids. It includes three of the perfluoroalkyl carboxylates and three of the perfluoroalkane sulfonates. And the data is freely available online. You can go and download it and check it out. I want to point out before I even move on that there's a paper that came out recently in ES&T. It's cited down at the bottom of the slide where they looked at this data. They discussed some of the same statistics that I'll be presenting on these slides, but they also did some work to understand the potential sources of some of these occurrences in this UCMR data set, and I encourage you to check it out if you want to learn more about this UCMR data. But there, overall, in the data set, there are about 4,900 systems that were sampled in the United States. So the EPA targeted every system in the U.S. that serves more than 10,000 people. Their objective was not to capture all of the systems smaller than that, but they did sample a subset of community-scale systems that serve less than or equal to 10,000 people. And no, for example, private systems. So this graph reflects some of the data looking only at detections within the data set, and those detections are sorted by the number of compounds that were detected within the data set. You can see that looking across the x-axis here at the bottom. And then, so each gray dot is a sample, and so the total perfluoroalkyl acids in each sample has been summed and can be referenced on the left-hand y-axis. The red dots are just the average of the total perfluoroalkyl acids within each group, and then those blue symbols are the percentage of each category that exceeded the lifetime health advisory, and that can be referenced on the right-hand y-axis. So a couple of takeaways from this data. First of all, that multiple perfluoroalkyl acids really are the norm, so these compounds don't tend to occur just one compound. They tend to occur in mixtures. In terms of the data set as a whole, there were about 200 systems in the United States that had detections of these compounds. That's about 4% of systems. So of those 200, which do we consider impacted? And that really depends on what standards you look at. So if you consider the EPA lifetime health advisories, that's 64 systems in the United States. of the ones that were sampled, but if you were to apply the New Jersey standards, for example, on the national scale, that number could more than double, and is likely even higher because the MRL that the EPA had for the data set is higher than the 10 nanogram per liter PFNA standard in New Jersey. So really, what we consider impacted could change based on the standards that people elect to adopt in their different regions. This looks at that UCMR data in a slightly different way. Now we're looking at it broken out by individual compounds and also by groundwater or surface water. So in the x-axis at the bottom, you can see the individual compounds. That G is for groundwater and the S is for surface water. These data just reflect the range of, of detections within each compound, as well as the average detection in log on the left-hand y-axis. And then the dots show the rate of detection, and that can be referenced to the right-hand y-axis. Overall, there were quite a range of detections, anywhere from 10 to 7,000 nanograms per liter. That maximum detection, the honor of that goes to PFOS, and PFOA was the most frequently detected compound. And then what I was really interested in when I first made this plot was how much groundwater comprised the issues that do exist within the United States. And if we look at it across all the samples there were that had detections, groundwater was the source of the water in 80% of the detections in those samples. You may wonder if that means that more groundwater than surface water systems were sampled, but it's about 50-50. There were about 2,800 groundwater systems and about 2,700 surface water systems. So looking at the individual compounds, you can see that the average in groundwater tends to be higher than the average measured concentration in surface water. There are a few exceptions. Certainly, the average total perfluoroalkyl acid concentration in groundwater is higher than that in surface water. And overall, we see a higher rate of detection in groundwater versus surface water. So when it comes to drinking water in the United States, we see that for those issues that do exist, groundwater is a significant piece of that problem. So the last question that I wanted to think about related to this UCMR data is whether or not this data is representative of the situation in the United States. And now what we're looking at is a map of communities in the New England region that have PFAS impacts in their drinking water in some form. This may not be a comprehensive map of all of the communities, but it's certainly a good portion of them. So this includes places like Hoosick Falls, New York, and Bennington, Vermont. And these are headlines that have come out in mainstream media about these communities in the last year to year and a half. It's interesting because if you look at the UCMR data, there were systems sampled in both Bennington, Vermont, as well as Pownall, Vermont, but the UCMR data have no detections in Vermont. And then there are other areas like Hoosick Falls, New York, that weren't captured as part of the UCMR effort where impacts are certainly present. The paper that I mentioned earlier in ES&T by WHO points out that the 800 smaller systems that were sampled comprises only about 0.5% of the smaller systems in the United States. And we do know from the UCMR data which systems are considered small and which are large. And if we break that out in terms of concentrations by small and large systems, this graph on the bottom left-hand corner of the slide illustrates that for the total perfluoroalkyl acid concentration, as well as for many of the individual compounds, the concentrations in the small systems were higher, but it was a very small sample size, so we do have to take that with a grain of salt. But regardless, I think that this suggests that there is some warranted targeted screening of these smaller community-scale systems, as well as private groundwater wells, but sampling all of those probably isn't realistic, so there needs to be some kind of efficient and effective design of screening programs of these drinking water aquifers that can be implemented on a regional basis. And so that's what we've been working towards at Brown, is trying to develop this kind of framework. So first, I think it's useful to understand why finding the sources of these compounds is so challenging. So I mentioned the high number of potentially relevant compounds, numbers of the compounds, as well as their wide variety of uses. And so this means that there are a lot of potential sources. So if you, for example, consider a traditional groundwater contaminant, something like MTBE, its primary uses is gasoline oxygenate, so it's easier to narrow down the potential sources of that compound. But with PFAS compounds, the uses and applications are quite diverse, and there's a lot of compounds, so a lot of potential sources. And then there's these low regulatory limits that are starting to come out for these compounds and the low parts per trillion levels, which brings a new relevance to things like small releases and indirect sources. And indirect sources might include things like, for example, atmospheric deposition or biosolids application. Whereas you may not have to target such small releases or indirect sources, for other types of contaminants, they are definitely relevant for PFAS compounds. And then lastly, it's really hard to compile all the data relative even to those PFAS sources that we are aware of. So going back to my example of MTBE, for example, if you knew that had come out of a leaking underground storage tank, odds are you'd be able to find some kind of current or historical record related to that underground storage tank, but that is not necessarily the case with PFAS sources, particularly for things like manufacturing facilities. That information is at best unconsolidated and sometimes missing. So if you're trying to design a sampling plan for a region and you put these challenges together without addressing them, this could lead to inefficient design of sampling plans or a failure to identify all of the potentially relevant sources, or even the inability to determine a source, which means that there's going to be an increased time associated with responding to this issue and ultimately to reducing risks associated with human health and the environment. So we have been trying to overcome some of these issues by designing a geospatial framework that can help in targeted design of sampling and analysis programs on a regional scale for PFAS compounds. Because we are in Rhode Island and because we have a really unique data set that I'll discuss in a minute, we are using Rhode Island as our current testing ground for this framework. So what we have done in Rhode Island is assemble information on all of the potential sources of PFAS compounds, and that would include things like landfills, the end users of PFAS-containing firefighting foams, so fire stations, fire training areas, airports. But then the really unique thing that we have for the state of Rhode Island is this database of former manufacturing facilities that goes back through most of the relevant history of PFAS use. We have this database thanks to a professor here at Brown University, Dr. Scott Frickel, and his graduate students, such as Tom Marlowe. They have been working to use paper copy manufacturing directories to get all of this historical manufacturing information. So basically, they have these manufacturing directories, and they have built a computational software that will digitize that information and create these GIS databases of these former manufacturing facilities. So we had former manufacturing of all different types for the entire state of Rhode Island. Not all of those are relevant to PFAS use. So we identified a subset of those manufacturing facilities based on industrial codes that are known to use or produce PFAS compounds. So I'll say right off the bat that this list of sites or potential sources does not necessarily connect any of these sources with any kind of known history of PFAS production or use. We have intentionally cast a wide net with the understanding that obtaining information on a site-by-site basis regarding PFAS use or production will not always be so feasible, especially on the regional scale. So we've cast a wide net, and then what we want to do is assign some sort of likelihood to each of those source types that a release may or may not have occurred. So we have calculated something that we call a hazard score, which basically has a release probability term multiplied by the years of operation for that facility, which we fortunately do have for most of these source types, but where we don't happen to have the years of operation, we conservatively assume that it is over the entire period of PFAS use. The release probability term is currently based a bit on professional judgment as well as what we know from the literature about likelihood of a release having occurred from that specific source type, but we are in the process of improving that based on collection of a large database of groundwater data from various different source types so that we can better understand the magnitude of groundwater impacts that can occur from each of these different source types. But once we have calculated this hazard score, we divided Rhode Island up into these 1-by-1-kilometer cells, and within, and that's what's shown on this grid on the left-hand side of the slide right now. Within any one of those cells, there can be more than one source type. I should have pointed out that the map of sources is largely pink, and that's because Rhode Island just happens to have a high density of former manufacturing facilities. The pink is former manufacturing, and those are centered around the city of Providence. So definitely within any 1-by-1-kilometer cell, you could have more than one of any of these source types. So we sum the hazard scores from the individual source types within any one cell. And so those scores are now plotted in that map on the right-hand side. And so where you see those regions of red and yellow are where we would consider there to be the highest probability of a release having occurred. That red is centered around the city of Providence, but just because that's a region where there's a high probability of release does not necessarily mean that there was a pathway for that release to make it into the saturated zone, and it also does not mean that that saturated zone is necessarily going, or an impacted saturated zone in that region would lead to exposure, for example, if that groundwater is not used as drinking water. So the next step in this analysis was to compare this to some kind of groundwater use and vulnerability. And so that's what's shown on this map here. So now we've applied a smoothing factor, and you'll note a couple of things. So the way that we assessed vulnerability was by looking at the proximity of these sites to groundwater recharge zones as well as public wellhead protection areas. Those are shown on the map now, shaded in dark purple. The other thing you might notice is that those red regions around Providence are gone. We actually took those out of this step of the analysis because the groundwater beneath Providence is not classified as drinking water. That groundwater is presumed to be degraded and does not have a beneficial use. Additionally, drinking water for Providence was screened as part of the UCMR data effort, so that did not necessarily need to be further evaluated as part of this. So now what you'll see is that instead of seeing high risk around these population-dense regions, what we see is that the actual risk for impacts to groundwater and potentially exposure are in these rural areas, and likely for smaller community-scale systems. And so the idea is that we would look at these regions of red, for example, relative to their locations or proximity to some of these smaller community-scale systems. And that comprises our next steps and sort of what we're currently working on now. So this is the same map as the previous slide, but now what we see are the locations of community-scale systems in Rhode Island, but buffered with a one-mile buffer. And so we would recommend that that some of these wells that have overlap with some of these regions shown in red should probably be prioritized as part of a regional sampling campaign. And that regional sampling campaign, the planning for that is underway. We've been working with the Rhode Island Department of Health, who plans to conduct a limited regional scale screening of these community scale systems. And so we hope to use this analysis to assist in sample point selection, and we also plan to assist with the sampling and analysis of those samples once they are collected. And ideally, we can take that data and use it to ground truth our approach and see how well we did. Also, there are some other regions that have already implemented regional groundwater screening programs, and with a little bit of luck, we may be able to apply this same framework towards those regions in the short term and see how well it works for predicting impacts that have already been observed in the groundwater data. And I have highlighted there that this is pending source data availability because I pointed out that we have this unique database of former manufacturing facilities in Rhode Island. It's very labor intensive to duplicate that type of database at this point. So what we would like to understand is the other kinds of or other avenues for availability of similar types of manufacturing information within the regulatory agencies. For example, can their permitting databases be used to duplicate at least some of this former manufacturing information and complete a similar exercise based on data that is more likely to be available in-house? We hope to use these ground truthing exercises to answer a couple of key questions. And one of the most important is, can we really identify the potential for releases, or can we really use the potential for a release to have occurred to identify regions of impact versus knowing, for example, that an individual source used or produced PFAS compounds, and also hopefully conclude something about the relative importance of having location information for each source type such that regions that might have limited data or limited resources can know where their priorities should be in terms of identifying these specific source types. And so with that, I would just like to quickly acknowledge the Brown University Superfund Research Program, which is where I sit and where we have been doing this work. My collaborators that I mentioned earlier, Dr. Scott Frickle and Thomas Marlowe, the manufacturing database is their hard work and their brainchild. My primary collaborator at the Rhode Island Department of Health, Amy Parmeter, as well as my advisor and mentor, Dr. Eric Suberg, the Suberg Lab Group, and of course, our funding agency, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And with that, I would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Jennifer. Do you have any, and I think you covered a little bit in the presentation, do you have any suggestions on identifying high and low priority sources? Also, what do you consider to be the potential sources?
So we kind of covered the list of sources. I'll go ahead and move back there so that you can see those. One too many. There we go. So that's kind of the different the source types that we have identified in terms of manufacturing. I don't have that list in front of me, but for example, it could include petroleum refinery, certain portions of the chemical industry, textiles, paper. I don't have the complete list of the industrial codes in front of me that we use, but they're all ones that are known to use or produce PFAS compounds, and I'm happy to share that detailed list if anybody wants to reach out to me following the webinar. I can tell you what industrial types we're looking for. But a lot of that information from what we have found in the different regions is not necessarily all together in one place, and that really is kind of the challenge with especially that manufacturing data.
Sure. Have you had any success in fingerprinting groundwater samples in an attempt to determine the source, especially where multiple potential sources exist?
That's not something that we've had the opportunity to work with yet on this project. So we're still in the process of helping Department of Health to look at where they should sample. And so based on those results, that might be a future avenue for this kind of work, but it's not the place that this project is currently.
What percentage of the RI residents who live in the rural areas use community drinking water versus private wells? Are you planning to reach out to any of those primarily residents on the private wells?
So my understanding from, and I'm not a regulator, and I don't want to speak too much for what Department of Health approach might be within Rhode Island should they find any hits for PFAS compounds in these rural regions, but my understanding from asking them that question is that the private wells would be prioritized based on any potential impacts that would be discovered in the community scale systems, but starting first with the community scale systems and considering private systems based on those results.
Thank you. Are there any published papers or other reports for the public to use the geospatial approach?
I wish I could say yes, but that is in progress, so stay tuned.
All right. Is municipal wastewater effluent considered a probable source of PFOAs?
The answer to that question is yes, but since we're considering primarily these sources to the drinking water aquifers, that's not something that we have included in this right now. I think that would be really relevant to surface water bodies, and then of course there can be surface water groundwater exchange, but right now that we're not including the wastewater treatment effluent outfalls as part of this. But maybe, you know, who knows, maybe we'll find that we need to.
Thank you. How much weight was placed on recharge zones in the spatial risk scoring? If a release occurs outside the regional recharge areas, there's still potential to impact the supply area.
Right. So they were weighted as being more relevant if they had overlap with the groundwater recharge zone, but if they did not have overlap with the groundwater recharge zone, they were not completely ignored. They just weren't scored as high.
Can you we have somebody who's working for a similar project in Nebraska, and she'd like to send you an email to ask can you send her the list?
Sure. Yep. I think my email address was on the webpage for the webinar series, and I'd be happy to speak with them.
Sure. What's your plans for when you actually are going to do the sampling and when your data might be available?
So, again, ultimately the sampling is part of an official Rhode Island Department of Health effort, so I don't want to say too much for the state agency. But a tentative plan is to do that late summer or early fall.
All right. What were the industry codes that you used for the manufacturing facilities?
Those, again, that's the list that I don't know off the top of my head. But if you're talking about which type of industry classification codes, we use the SIC codes. But which codes were used specifically, that would be – somebody should just reach out to me, and I can discuss more about the individual codes that were used.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? If not, we will move on to our next presentation. see any other questions on the board. I'll give it just a second because we've got an extra minute. All right, let's see. Hang on. What PFAS compounds will you be analyzing for?
In the Rhode Island, so Rhode Island samples are most likely going to be analyzed by their own in-house analytical capability at the Rhode Island Department of Health. They are targeting currently, I believe, 9 perfluoroalkyl acids, and additional analysis of additional compounds at Brown is a potential pending the results of the screening for the 9 compounds.
All right. Well, I think that's the last of the questions that we have so far. If anybody submits any additional questions, we will try to answer them at the end of the presentation, at the end of the presentations if we have time. So I want to thank you very much, Jennifer, for your presentation, and we are going to move on now to Dr. Mark Brousseau. Dr. Brousseau is a professor in the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Arizona, with appointments in the Soil, Water, and Environmental Science Department and the Hydrology and Atmospheric Science Department. Dr. Brousseau is a member of several professional societies, is a fellow of the American Geophysical Union and the Geological Society of America and the Soil Science Society of America. Dr. Brousseau's research is focused on developing a fundamental understanding of the factors and processes influencing the transport and fate of contaminants in the subsurface. He is also interested in the development and evaluation of innovative subsurface remediation and characterization technologies, then the evaluation of risk posed by human health to human health by contamination. Dr. Brousseau, I'll turn it over to you.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your participation in the webinar today. So I'm going to talk briefly about the Integrated Contaminant Elution and Tracer Test Toolkit. So moving to the next slide, I'm going to briefly outline the contaminant elution test itself, talk about some of the advantages and applications, and then briefly about implementation, and then finish up with a brief case study. So moving to slide 3, a contaminant elution test is conducted by extracting groundwater or soil vapor for an extended time period while monitoring the concentrations of your contaminants of concern in the effluent. So the length of time for the extraction would depend on site conditions and on your test objectives. So in slide 4, shows an example of the type of data that would be collected from a CET test. And so we have concentrations versus time for our COCs. And you know, we can do qualitative analysis of these data, for example, examining the elution profiles for landmarks. And we can do quantitative analysis, such as mathematical modeling. So moving to slide 5, there are several advantages associated with these CET tests. The first one is that it's conducted under induced gradient conditions, which stresses the system, enhancing the hydraulic and concentration gradients. So this provides improved sensitivity for measuring mass transfer and attenuation processes. So this is particularly useful for sites where there's processes operating with very small rate coefficients or large characteristic times. It also provides an integrated measurement over the interrogated domain, and so this reduces uncertainty associated with the spatial variability that crops up in point-based methods. We can modify the CET test by injecting clean water to displace the resident solution, such as the background plume. So when we do this, it allows us to focus on the processes that are occurring locally at our test site and the fluxes associated with them. We can use tracers with the CET test to help characterize specific processes and associated rates, and so that's where the ISET term comes in. And then finally, these tests are relatively rapid and low cost compared to other characterization methods. So moving to slide 6, the application of these tests, our objective is to provide improved characterization of mass transfer processes, attenuation processes, and then the mass removal observed at a site. And so ultimately, we anticipate that the information gained from these tests would improve our decision-making for cost-effective site management. just like any other site characterization tool, we would anticipate that these would be used with other characterization methods at a particular site. So moving to slide 7, there are several applications for which we can use these ISET or CET tests. The first one is to measure contaminant mass discharge. The second is to characterize mass removal and persistence behavior, to delineate specific mass transfer and attenuation processes, to determine the specific rate coefficients for those processes, to estimate resident contaminant mass, and finally to test prospective remedial actions. And so now I'm going to go through a few examples of these applications. So in slide 8, here is the contaminant mass discharge. And so that represents the mass that's discharging from a zone of interest to downgradient. And so the CMD has become a significant metric, for example, for assessing remedial action performance. And so for the data presented in the figure on the left is an example from tests that we conducted at a site in Arizona. And so we conducted CET tests to measure contaminant mass discharge versus time before and after implementing an in-situ chemical oxidation remedial action for that source zone. And so we can use these data to quantify the reduction in mass discharge accruing to that ISCO application. As a side note, a little note on the right there, CMD was included in the ROD as a remedial action objective for the Commencement Bay South Tacoma Channel Superfund site. So as far as I can determine from asking EPA personnel, this is the first time that CMD was included formally in a ROD as an REO. So moving to slide 9, here is another set of elution curves obtained from CET tests. And so as I mentioned, we can do qualitative analyses to help characterize the mass removal and persistence behavior for that contaminated site. So for example, we can examine landmarks such as shown here. And I don't see the arrow showing up. Anyway, I don't see it. Oh, there it is. Okay, thank you. So for example, here the blue diamond data is showing relatively high concentration steady state profile compared to the green data showing steady state behavior at a much lower concentration. And then the black data set here is showing asymptotic behavior tending down towards MCL concentrations. And so we can use these data to help us understand the mass removal behavior for a particular site once we have these results from a test. Moving to slide 10, we can further assess these data by examining the relationship between the reduction in mass discharge and the mass removal. So on the figure on the left here represents a standard illustration of this type of relationship analysis where we have on the x-axis the fraction of mass reduction from the CET test or any other type of mass removal process. And then on the y-axis, we have the corresponding reduction in mass discharge as a function of that mass removal. Also shown on the figure are three theoretical relationships. The first one here, represented by the dashed red curve, is a maximal reduction in mass discharge as a function of mass reduction. Then the corresponding blue dotted curve represents minimal reduction in mass discharge as a function of mass reduction. And then the one-to-one relationship is shown here in the straight line. And then superimposed on this figure, we have data measured for a site in Arizona. And so again, we can use this type of information to help assess the mass removal conditions prevalent at that particular site. So for example, the data here are represented primarily above the one-to-one line, so that would be indicating to us that there's a significant fraction of mass through which its removal is rate limited by some process. And so it's not hydraulically accessible to the flowing groundwater, for example. On the right-hand side of the figure is the same figure presented in a log format so that we can focus on the low concentration behavior such as related to the MCL range. So moving to slide 11, as I mentioned, when we have data such as this, we have these elution profiles. We're trying to use them to understand the specific processes contributing to this observed mass removal behavior. When we have a site that has a single predominant mass removal process, that's a relatively straightforward endeavor. However, we would anticipate that at many sites, there's multiple processes influencing mass removal. So in that case, we can use tracer suites to help us to delineate the specific mass transfer and attenuation processes operating at a site. And so this schematic here is illustrating the use of a tracer suite to measure various processes. And so here is a specific example on slide 12, where I have a theoretical set of breakthrough curves obtained from using a tracer suite. So we have relative concentration of the particular tracer, or here in red, the COC elution curve plotted in the y-axis versus time for the test. And so we can use different non-reactive tracers that have different diffusion coefficients, for example, to characterize diffusive mass transfer between zones of lower and higher permeability. We can use tracers to characterize sorption and retardation potential. We can also use tracers to characterize transformation attenuation potential from biological and chemical degradation processes. And of course, many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with using NAPL partitioning tracers to help characterize NAPL in the source zones. So moving to slide 13, we can also use the data collected from CET tests to estimate resident contaminant mass. So this parameter, as we know, is typically unknown for most sites and is very difficult to determine. However, it's a critical parameter for accurate risk assessments and for design of remedial actions. And so we can conduct a CET test to measure contaminant mass discharge versus time, as I'm plotting here on log scale. And then we can fit a source depletion function to these data that's represented here by this regression curve. And from that, we can obtain an estimate of the initial mass that was present at the start of the test. And so this example I'm showing in the figure represents data collected for a source zone in a site, at a site in Arizona. And as a result of the test, we obtained an estimate of 993 kilograms for the initial mass. And this compared very favorably within 20% of the mass estimate we obtained using the standard sediment core characterization. Moving to slide 14 now, briefly talking about implementation. So when we implement a CET test, a key design factor is the well field configuration. And so, of course, this well field configuration is going to be based on your objectives of your test. And so I'm showing here in the figure on the left three example representative well field configurations. First, we have the standard dipole with a single injection well and single extraction well. Then we have a double dipole example here with one extraction well and two injection wells. And then here we have an example of a nested dipole set where we have one dipole nested within an outer one. And so, for example, and to illustrate the effect of these well field configurations on test behavior, we have simulations here from mathematical modeling we conducted. And so we have three simulated elution curves here. And the objective for this simulation test case was to examine the degree of isolation of the extraction well from the surrounding plume. And so we can see for configuration with the blue curve, which represents the nested dipole system, that we have complete isolation of the extraction well from the surrounding plume after the first few days of the test. So if one of your objectives requires the isolation of the extraction well from the plume, then now we can see that which one of these three configurations provides the best isolation. Okay, so moving to slide 15, the case study This field site is the Tucson International Airport Area Superfund site in Tucson. And so we can see here on the map here, for example, are the runways for the airport. And so this site was placed on the NPL in 1983. The primary contaminant of concern is trichloroethylene, TCE. We can see the TCE plume in the regional groundwater here outlined in red, demarcated by the 5 microgram per liter MCL level. And then as a side note, this pink plume represents the footprint for 1,4-dioxane. So this site has multiple operable units and remedial operations in progress. For the rest of the talk, I'm going to be focusing on this, what's called the south part of the TIA site, which is the Air Force Plant 44, and that's this region here. This figure presents composite concentrations of TCE in groundwater coming into the treatment plant from a large-scale pump and treat system that has been operating since 1987. So this data, as you can see, is a very high resolution, wonderful data set to help characterize mass removal for the site. So we have 30 years of data to examine. And so we can see when they first started up operations after stabilization, the concentrations peaked close to 600 micrograms per liter, and then there was a rapid decline for the first 2 years. Then, of course, about year 3.5, there was a significant change in slope. And so from then on, we observed asymptotic behavior to the point of the last 10 years, it's almost essentially steady state behavior in terms of concentrations. And so this steady state concentration profile is still several times higher than the target 5 micrograms per liter. The red curve represents cumulative mass removed for operation of the pump and treat system, and so we can see significant reduction in the rate of mass removal as well. And so this behavior that we observe here is typical for many of the long-term pump and treat systems that we have at these chlorinated solvent sites. So we were very fortunate to get involved early on with the site, going on to the next slide. And so we conducted numerous studies at the site to help understand the transport and fate behavior of TCE and other contaminants at the site with the goal of improving the effects of the remedial operations at the site. And so this included conducting several contaminant elution and tracer tests. So moving to slide 18, for example, we conducted a diffusive tracer test that I mentioned before, where we have two non-reactive tracers, bromide and HPCD, cyclodextrin. So the diffusion coefficient for HPCD is several times smaller than the diffusion coefficient for bromide. And so the premise of this diffusive tracer test is that, of course, the rate of diffusion between zones of different permeability will be a function of the diffusion coefficient. And so here now we conducted a tracer test, and you can see breakthrough curves for the tracers, and we observe that the breakthrough curve for HPCD has greater spreading than the one for bromide. So this is indicating that we have an impact of diffusive mass transfer on transport of the tracers. And so at the site, there is a major clay unit, as I'm depicting here in the schematic, that's right at the interface between the Beto zone and the regional groundwater. And so tests have shown that there's high concentrations of TCE in this clay unit. And so the combination of this information is indicating that so-called back diffusion would be a significant contributor to mass removal for the site. Moving to slide 19, this is an example of the partitioning tracer test that we conducted at the site. So the premise of the partitioning tracer test is that we have a tracer that will partition in and out of the non-aqueous phase liquid, delaying its transport compared to that of a non-reactive tracer that stays in solution. And so here is an example set of breakthrough curves. So we can observe that we do have delay or retardation of the partitioning tracer compared to the non-partitioning tracer, so indicating the presence of NAPL in that test site. And we are able to use this information to determine a saturation for that interrogated domain. On the right-hand side here is an example of a CET test where we conducted extended time period and then we did a stop flow at the end. And so we observed from this that we initially have very high concentrations greater than 10 milligrams per liter in groundwater. And then we have an extended period of a very high steady state profile at close to 3 milligrams per liter. And after we stop the flow, we have an extensive rebound. So putting all of this information together, then we have indications that we have presence of DNAPL in the source zone, and that's likely a significant factor mediating mass removal for the site. So we can use all of this information for slide 20. We have another example of a CET test. So right here we have measured elution profile here for a TCE. And then we can use this now that we have identified NAPL dissolution as a significant process. Now we can use numerical modeling, including NAPL dissolution. And so this is showing three simulated elution curves with the impact of the dissolution rate coefficient. So this is an example of how we can use the CET data to quantify a specific mass removal process. So moving to slide 21. Now we use all of this information and other information to conduct a plume scale mathematical modeling effort. So just as an example here in the right is a figure showing our permeability distribution developed for the site. And so using all of this information, we were able to do the plume scale modeling of TCE removal during the pump and treat system. And so I'm showing here the measure data along with two simulations, so with and without NAPL in the source zones. And so we go back again to the plume map for a moment. And so the source zone that I'm talking about is a small area here and here, about the size of a soccer field or two for each, compared to this entire area that we've modeled transport. And so this result clearly shows the significant impact having NAPL and its dissolution in these two local source zones on the entire plume scale behavior. And so we're able to use this information to predict the impact of source zone remediation. And so in situ chemical oxidation using permanganate solutions was implemented for those source zones at the site. And this, again, you saw this data before. This is an example of CET test that we conducted before and after the ISCO to measure CMD as a function of time. And so we can see CMD before coming to a nice steady state behavior, then after ISCO, we can see significantly lower, 75% lower CMD. And here on the right is just the corresponding sediment core data showing a reduction in sediment phase TC concentrations after ISCO was conducted. Then finally, we can compare all this source zone measurements from the CET test and sediment coring to the plume scale aggregate CMD behavior obtained from the pump and treat data. So that's what's shown in this figure. This is mass discharge tabulated from the pump and treat system, meaning it represents composite mass discharge for the entire plume as a function of before and after ISCO. So we can see the steady state behavior for the entire site before ISCO started, then after ISCO, significant reduction in mass discharge. Then ISCO stopped, and we can see a rebound, as we might anticipate, and then it's back to another steady state at 70% smaller CMD. And so this 70% compares quite well to the 75% reduction we measured using the source scale CMD tests. So in summary, hopefully these This brief presentation has illustrated the utility of contaminant elution and tracer tests for site characterization, particularly for focusing on measuring mass removal behavior and CMD, contaminant mass discharge, for helping to characterize mass transfer and attenuation processes. And again, this would be just one component of a full site assessment. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. We appreciate that. I have the first question. Is it possible that high-pressure injection is forcing the COC into the saprolite micropores and masking mass transfer for the plume, which would have moved via the micropores, as well as incorrect estimates of removal because now more of the COC is being held for longer?
I'm not quite sure what is meant by the high-pressure injections. If you mean during the CE test itself, the injection and extraction flow rates are quite moderate and are matched, and so we wouldn't anticipate there would be any significant impact from the injection and extraction itself on long-term distribution of the contaminants. So when we use a dipole, for example, and we inject the clean water, then we're sweeping the resident plume mass out within the first few days of operation, depending on site scale. So after that, then the concentration signal that we're monitoring in the extraction well should pretty much be focused on the rate-limited mass transfer processes that are influencing the mass removal for that local site. So that's the hope, anyway.
How do you select the locations and number of soil samples for comparison?
That would be a function of the test objectives and of the site. So when we were doing our coring, it depended on which site we were working at and the funds available, et cetera. So for some sites, we are only able to have a few cores just for kind of illustrative purposes. We weren't trying to determine quantitative assessments with that data. But for the one site, I'll go back to the example. For this example here, we actually had several thousand sediment samples collected from a very small, relatively small area for comparison.
How do you evaluate or quantify the variability of the concentrations in the soil data?
In the soil data or in the concentrations from the CET tests? So here, for the CET test data, we can see some variability in the contaminant mass discharge. So that will be coming from both variability in the concentrations we're measuring and in the flow rates. So we have good measurements of flow rate and concentration, so we're able to do a good job of characterizing the uncertainty associated with this data, as you can see here. In terms of, say, associated sediment data that we collect, then that would be using some standard geostatistical kind of assessments for numbers of cores and numbers of samples, et cetera.
Have you performed elution and tracer tests for PFAS compounds, specifically PFOA and PFOS? How do they compare to the elution of chlorinated VOCs?
No, we haven't had the fortune, if you will, to have done that yet for those particular compounds. But we would expect that it would be quite interesting behavior for those compounds, as we discussed earlier, given the different types of retention processes that might be influencing their retention and transport. But no, we haven't had the opportunity to conduct tests specifically for those compounds.
On slide 19, what day did the pumping stop?
Okay, let's go to slide 19. Okay, yes. We stopped extraction right here where it's a little noisy.
Okay.
And so that, then these concentrations then represent the rebound after we stop the flow from here to here.
What was your soil data, or specifically, what was the heterogeneity of the soil?
At the TIA site, it's very, very heterogeneous, and so we have sand and gravel units all the way to this laterally extensive, significant, several meter thick clay unit here. So it's very, very heterogeneous at this site. Several orders of magnitude differences between permeabilities.
Were you using ISCO to remediate the DNAPL?
Yes, that's correct. So at this site, ISCO was conducted at those two primary source zones that I noted here. So right here and another source zone right here. So that's where the ISCO was conducted. And yes, it was to address primarily the DNAPL that we had observed evidence of from our prior tests that I mentioned.
Have you had the opportunity to do the test for BTEX compounds in the dissolved phase?
Yes, we did for one site, another site in Tucson. It was much smaller scale plume, of course, at a gasoline service station, a tank field, tank farm. That's the word I'm looking for, tank farm. And so, yes, we were able to evaluate mass removal behavior for the BTEX compounds.
Thank you. Could you help explain how the shallow clay layer shown in the conceptual site model slide related to the COC distribution shown in the ladder modeling slide? The relationship of the conceptual site model to the actual model is not clear.
Okay, so here we have the conceptual site model, and then here is our distribution of permeabilities we developed using core information from, I don't remember the exact number, 120, 130 boreholes. And so here is the red color is the lower permeabilities. And so we can see the extensive low permeability units here through this part.
Going back to slide 19, which, it does not look like the COC distribution reached reached asymptote before it was started to climb back up. What were the reasons for the increase, and how is the failure to reach the asymptote factored into the NAPL strengths assessment?
Yes, so for these data, for example, we are observing this steady state type behavior. We do not see the asymptotic behavior. That's correct. And so this is indicating that we have in the vicinity of our interrogated domain that we have a strong supply, if you will, of TCE that is continuing to maintain this high steady state concentration. And keep in mind that we injected clean water with this CET test, and so we swept the plume out, if you will, from the test domain. And so this is a signal coming from whatever contaminant mass is isolated in our test domain, and so we have significant mass transfer of TCE from non-aqueous domain, whether it's sorbed mass or mass in a clay layer or DNAPL mass. But then given the high concentrations that we see here, plus this extensive rebound, and in combined with the results of the partitioning tracer test, that allows us to delineate that we most likely have DNAPL phase contributing mostly to this extensive steady state behavior.
Right. What specific contaminants were characterized at the Tacoma Superfund site?
At that site, they have a whole laundry list of compounds. They have chlorinated solvents for sure. They also have some BTEC, some hydrocarbons there. So it's a very mixed waste type site. So it's a very interesting site. And as I mentioned, as far as I can tell from what EPA colleagues have told me, that's the first time that CMD was included formally as an RAO in the record of decision, the revised record of decision. And so they conducted a CMD test, a CET test to measure CMD before implementing the remedial actions, and then they just actually completed the post-remedial action test.
Thank you, Mark. That's all the questions that we have at the moment. If there are some additional questions, we have a few more minutes. If anybody would like to write this in, I'm going to go back to Dr. Jennifer Guelfo. We have an additional question for you. Jennifer, are you there? May be on mute.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, there you go.
Okay.
Do you think EPA would revise the lifetime health advisory, and if so, why?
I don't even want to venture an answer to that question. All I will say along that front, I don't know anything about EPA's plans and wouldn't want to presume anything. The only thing that I will point out, I didn't really have time to go through it, but the information was on my slide that had the regional standards on it, is that there are other regulatory agencies who are opting to use a different reference dose than the one that EPA used to develop their 70 nanogram per liter standard. So that was based on a developmental delay endpoint, but other regulatory agencies are looking at other endpoints and also making some different assumptions that go into development of those water quality standards, for example, use of different drinking water ingestion rates. But in terms of EPA's plans, I don't even want to venture an answer to that.
Thank you. I have back for Dr. Brousseau. How was the CDM used? Was the CDM used to state a specific contaminant discharge that would be met for the site certification closure?
Yes. So if I recall correctly, you should check their reports just to make sure. But if I recall correctly, they wrote in something like a maybe 90% reduction in CMD was the RAO. But you should check. You should check their documentation to make sure.
All right. Thank you. We've got, let's see, one more. What suggestions do you have for promoting regulatory acceptance, Dr. Brousseau, of flux-based methods in characterization remediation? Not a new problem, but it needs new approaches, new angles. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, so I think that was actually a reason I included that side note about the Commencement Bay Superfund site is illustrating, I think, that the CMD as a metric has progressed through the ranks, if you will, and now my feeling is that it's being accepted by quite a broad spectrum now of regulators and site managers and consulting firms, et cetera. So there's still, you know, room to move and go, but I think it's making progress. And just showing examples like the one I've shown and the one at Commencement Bay, hopefully that'll get written up sometime. I think you showing this information will help continue to move it along to wide acceptance.
Dr. Brousseau, how expensive is it to use the CETs? Is it practical for large sites?
So I would say that it's relatively inexpensive compared to some other standard methods. So it just depends on what other methods you might compare them to. So if you were going to conduct, say, sediment coring, for example, we all know how expensive that is depending on your depth and how many samples you need and the size of your site. So compared to sediment core characterization specifically, I would say it's much, much lower cost. So you essentially, assuming that you have infrastructure at the site, which at many sites we would have already have extraction wells, injection wells, or wells that we can use for injection and extraction. If we have them, we don't have to drill anything new, put any more infrastructure. And so really it comes down to just the cost of time, people's time for conducting the tests and analyzing data, and then the analytical costs for the samples. So it's really quite inexpensive, we found, compared to sediment coring, for example.
All right. And one last question. In reference to the RAOs, it would seem that the CET is more useful as a performance metric than as a closure metric. And would you agree?
I think it's more directly connected to performance, yes. So I think we can clearly directly assess performance using CMD as a metric. I think using it for closure assessment is premised on the connection between reductions in CMD and then the associated reduction in mass at the site or concentrations emanating from the source or zone of interest. So yeah, there's an extra connection there that's being made for that.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark, for the presentation and answering the questions, and Jennifer as well for jumping back in. Before we conclude, I want to make sure everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and the seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also, in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form and that we asked you to consider filling out this form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would like to remind participants of various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of our webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN .org website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page, follow the EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter, join the Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN LinkedIn group, visit the SRP Research e-learning webpage, and follow SRP NIEHS on Twitter. And we are now approaching the 3 p.m. Eastern time, so we will have to conclude the seminar. If you, I don't see any additional questions that were answered online, but if you have something that was missed or wasn't answered as detailed as you would like, if you would submit an online question, and we will send your question on to the presenters. If you have additional questions, again, you can contact the presenters via email. Our email addresses are on the presenter tab and on the CLUIN seminar webpage. I would like to thank our presenters, Carrie Hornbuckle, Jennifer Guolfo, and Mark Brousseau, for their time in preparing and sharing their presentations with us today.